Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Yeah, you can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
The preparations of the Cape Verde national team for the Africa Cup of Nations were not exactly what you would call ideal. Their manager, captain, and all three goalkeepers were among the many squad members to test positive for COVID before the tournament began. But their luck finally turned after 10 minutes of their opening game against Ethiopia last night. A red card for their opponents, opening the door. They took full advantage, they won the game, and have given themselves a great shot at making the knockout rounds. Why am I paying so much attention to the trials and tribulations of the Cape Verde national team, I hear you ask? Well, it's because there's an Irishman at the heart of their defence, and we're going to be speaking to him on today's Second Captain's Football podcast. Hi, Ken. Hi, Ciarán.
Hey, Owen. How's it going?
How are you, Owen? How are you doing?
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. Roberto Lopez, centre-half with the League of Ireland champion Shamrock Rovers, made his debut for the country of his father's birth in late 2019. But it's an international career that very nearly didn't happen. The story goes, Roberto initially ignored a LinkedIn message in Portuguese from the manager who was looking to recruit him to the cause, presuming it was spam, didn't have it translated at the time. And only when they contacted him again a number of months later did he realise he was being invited to become an international footballer. So he said he'd give it a go, and now here he is on the opening night of the Africa Cup of Nations in action. So the lesson in all this is, I guess, always open your spam messages. Doesn't sound like great advice, actually, in terms of cybersecurity.
Even worse would be to always open your LinkedIn messages. That would be even worse.
Yeah.
I think I'd rather go into my spam than
I don't even
click on every LinkedIn email I get.
I don't even open most of my emails at this stage. I don't care. What does it say on my email now?
Oh, I've thousands. I've thousands there.
I don't have any. No. I delete immediately.
71,410 unopened emails.
Oh, no, I'm not that bad. That's a lot of emails. Unbelievable.
You know, I just don't like receiving communications from the world. I mean, it started with the post, you know. I mean, I remember years and years ago, it was so exciting to get a letter. I mean, that was in the days before I used to get bills. Anything that arrived for me was usually, it's someone has sent me a letter. And,
sending you a letter.
Pen pals.
Back in the 90s. We're talking the 1980s
and
90s.
Yeah, and I'm talking in the 80s and 90s. Who's sending you a letter?
Maybe my daddy might be sending me a letter from his job away in Norway.
Fair. That's a very fair point, Murphy. Yeah.
Or, you know, whatever, my friends. We used to write each other. Then we sit down and write a letter. How about that?
Have you written to him?
Then you started getting like bills, and you're like, oh, a lot of the communication I receive in the post now is threatening. Like it's not good. Like it's not only not interesting, but it's actually actively frightening, you know? And so I stopped opening all my mail like years ago. But now I've extended it to emails. I don't even open them anymore. So
if this is the policy that you employed in this case.
No, God knows what I would be doing if I opened them. But it's just too much, Owen. Who has the time?
Well, we're going to talk to Roberto Lopez on today's pod. We kicked off the Second Captain's World Service New Year last week by employing the 3V broadcasting approach: veganism, VAR, and vaccines. Now, this may indeed be the textbook way to attract new listeners, but even so, we thought we'd leave it until this week to bring you some major Second Captain's news for 2022. The first bit of news is that we have a new major news bower on. Murph, hit it.
Sorry, actually, just hold on. Sorry, hold on one second. I just have to drop the microphone and get the... Hold on one second. Okay, let's go.
Jesus, you've gotten good at that, Murph. Woo! Excellent Barons.
Will you hear me playing the rim in a minute? Anyway, on you go.
First up, Isolating with David O'Doherty returns for Series 3 today, so we can now literally call it a tripod. That's Mark Horgan's gag, not mine. If you're already in the weird and wonderful community of Isolators, or if you fancy giving the DOD a try, become a member and you can listen to all of his 3 shows a week. You're going to have to be a member to listen to all of his shows. Well, that's nice, Murph. I like that.
Yeah, it's playing the rim there, that is.
Yeah. Okay. Our next international podcast series has gone into production, folks. Your €5 a month is crucial in allowing us to pursue these bigger long-term projects. And after the impact of Where is George Gibney, we can confirm that Mark and the team are working on a major new series in 2022. That's not all. UK listeners, we'll be announcing London shows for our massive crew over there very soon on the World Service. You'll have to be a member to get tickets. That's also the case for the extra nights that we'll be doing in our springtime Gangs All Here shows at the Liberty Hall, which will basically take over the whole month of March. Stay tuned for ticket news very soon. You okay there, Murphy? Getting tired?
No, I'm just getting into the swing of things here. I can go on for days on days.
And of course, we'll bring you all the usual big name interviews and features on the Second Captain's World Service. We have a huge football guest lined up for the game that changed my life and an interview with a Pulitzer Prize winner to come soon. So we're going big in 2022. That's what I'm saying to you. Your €5 a month really does go a long way. €5 plus VAT. Please do join us today at secondcaptains.com. And thank you so much if you're already a member. You're amazing. Murph, take her home.
Okay, that's me.
Beautiful.
That's me.
Beautiful. Whew. Excellent, Murph. Well done.
Ah, listen. I mean, you know, what can I say? You know, my first New Year's resolution, learn a new musical instrument. It's gone pretty well. I mean, it took all the 10 days, but I got there, you know.
Already.
At the end of the day, it's just, you know. Just hitting a drum, so I mean, how difficult could it be, quite frankly?
That's true. One final note, if you're a listener in the Manchester area, let us know if you'd like us to do a live show this year where you are too. There could be an opportunity there, so tweet us at Second Captains or email editor at secondcaptains.com if you want to drive that baby. Isolating is going to be our second podcast out today, so no word on whether David will be covering the latest twist in the Novak Djokovic Australian Open story, so how about we'll do that at the end of this podcast just to make sure it's covered for you. But first, it's Report on Sport.
Oh, and how did you enjoy being the sort of fairy godmother of the magic of the cup this weekend?
I felt...
The FA Cup magic midwife is how I'd describe Paul McGavin.
You were dispensing magic. I was watching you. You said, I'll show you what happened in the Spurs game. And then, I was like, and then you said, you probably know what happened already as you have the internet. And I was like, indeed I do, but I am looking forward to seeing the goals. Mm. Morecambe with a heavily Irish influenced...
They had an Irish captain. They had an Irish manager on the touchline.
Dermot O'Carroll of Kerry. Anthony O'Connor of Cork. But unfortunately, Harry Kane.
Of Letterfrack.
Letterfrack had the last laugh. A nice finish, actually, by Harry Kane. And, you know, it was looking bad for Tottenham for a long time, you know. And actually, I wonder what the kind of long-term reverberations of that are going to be, or even short-term reverberations. Ndombele seemed to have a bit of a Xhaka moment almost from the crowd. Not quite as bad as that. I'm referring here to the moment when Xhaka was booed off by the crowd and like threw his own shirt on the ground and all this kind of stuff. Ndombele was just sort of booed off by the crowd, which seems as though maybe he's not hasn't succeeded in impressing Antonio Conte so far. But why am I talking about this game in particular, Owen, as it was the expected result, when in fact there were games where the result was not expected? None more so than at Newcastle, although it wasn't that much of a surprise, was it? Wes Hoolihan came on for the last half hour for Cambridge as they won 1-0 against Newcastle with a goal which I have to say I think was clearly offside, but for some reason was given anyway because they just sort of thought, well, you know, Newcastle, one of the Newcastle defenders sort of had a touch on the ball. I'm like, yeah, of course he had a touch. He has a touch on the ball because he's trying to stop it getting through to that offside Newcastle player who he can't be sure whether that player is offside. And that goal should not be given, but it was given. Newcastle got knocked out and everybody was sort of laughing.
Did you not know, Ken? The magic of the cup overrides
the rules.
All technology. Yeah. Rules, so, technology, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Magic supersedes it all.
Well, the magic of the cup also was too much for Arsenal, who unveiled an admirable anti-knife crime initiative with the help of Idris Elba, who I think had somehow been involved in the design of their white kits, which they wore against... Nottingham Forest won the game, and Arsenal had no shots on target. and Nuno Tavares, their fullback, was taken off in the first half. Meanwhile, someone they might have been able to use, Ashley Maitland-Niles, was... Where was Ashley Maitland-Niles? He was in the Stadio Olimpico in Rome, playing for Roma in one of the best games I've ever seen.
Oh, you were watching this? Yeah, I saw people getting very excited about it.
I was lucky enough that I was in a situation where I actually couldn't see the BBC. I threw on instead the Serie A game, Roma-Juventus. I saw that Roma were leading at the time, and I turned it on in the first half. And then it was really the second half, which was just incredible. Roma are 1-0 up. Tammy Abraham had scored, one of their three English players in Jose Mourinho's starting lineup. And then Mkhitaryan scored a deflected goal, kind of looped over Chesney in the Juventus goal. And then Pellegrini scores an amazing free kick to make it 3-1. And this was like, you know, 10 minutes into the second half, and it's now 3-1 to Roma. So Juventus are absolutely going down in flames. And Juventus have already had the disastrous moment. And this is the worst thing about this game. A disaster strikes them in the first half when Federico Chiesa, I mean, the favorite player, among the top five favorite players of anyone who's ever seen him play, I believe.
I think he could be up there right at the top for you these days, Murph.
Oh.
Has done his cruciate ligament.
This is actually, it's just too much of a Monday morning news story for me. I'm just, it's horrific.
It's terrible.
It is. It's a footballing tragedy.
Who's going to tell you, S. Murph? I mean, I did see Clay Thompson has just come back from years out.
And the San Francisco 49ers won one of the best American football games I've ever seen last night.
So he'll be okay. He's going to be okay. He might be able to recover.
He's going
to
be okay. But this Chiesa news will put a stop to his gallop a little today, I fear.
Well, they have to get past the playoffs, right, to qualify for the World Cup in the first place, which now Chiesa is... unlikely to be playing. I mean,
well, the daftness of the November World Cup does play into Chiesa's hands a little here.
I still think it's too soon, you know, to be fit enough to make Italy's World Cup squad in 10 months' time, having busted your cruciate. Now, it looked like nothing. You know, it was one of those where, you know, so you see some injuries and you're like, oh, that's a massive injury. You know, this is a disaster. You know, I mean, I remember... for instance, Oxlade-Chamberlain against Roma a few years ago. I remember Oxlade-Chamberlain suffered a cruciate ligament injury against Roma, but it was a different type of situation. It was like, you know, he was going in for a tackle, running fast against the players running fast, and they sort of fell, and the knee sort of buckled awkwardly underneath as the players were falling, kind of tangled together. Chiesa was just sort of turning on the ball. Like, it looked like nothing. And his knee just sort of seemed to pop, and that was it. Anyway, look, Chiesa, it's a terrible injury. It's a disaster. But in the game itself, things were not going much better for Juventus. 3-1 down to Roma. Jose Mourinho was absolutely, obviously, loving it. But then, Alvaro Morata diddles the fullback, puts over a cross, Locatelli heads it in. Jose Mourinho on the sideline springs into action. He replaces he takes off his young Ghanaian, Felix Afenajan, and he replaces him with the more experienced Uzbek Eldor Shomurodov. Unfortunately, Eldor Shomurodov doesn't seem to be quite up to speed because he comes in and he's sort of meant to be bolstering the sort of left side of the defense. You know, the player he's replacing is sort of left wing, but Jose's gone to a sort of a more defensive orientation, let's say. And unfortunately, Shomurodov manages to not really notice or finds it quite difficult to get a fix on the position of old Cuadrado for Juventus, who just gets away from him like in the next minute. Like, literally his first action of the game is to lose Cuadrado, who gets in, crosses, Morata has a go, gets deflected out, comes back out, Kulusevski, bang, 3-2, there's a VAR appeal, but it's a goal. So it's 3-2, and you know, it's two goals in 2 minutes is always you know, everyone is now sitting up and paying attention to what's happening here. And as Roma desperately scrabble to get back into the game, Juventus come forward again, and their left back Decilio suddenly they just chip a simple ball over the defense. He runs through and he bangs it in, and it is now 4-3 to Juventus, having been 3-1 to, like, it's absolutely unbelievable. But wait, there's more, Roma then run up the other end, lash a ball into the box. Abraham again gets a volley on it, and the ball travels 6 inches from his boot to the elbow of Matthijs de Ligt, who is jumping to try and block. Hits him on the elbow. The referee not only gives a penalty on VAR, but sends de Ligt off for a second yellow card, which to me just seemed like an insane decision. Like, how can you double punish this? Like, I mean, it's like a... If you're going to give a penalty because you're like, oh, look at his arm position, blah, blah, blah. Is that not enough? Rather than also inflicting a second yellow for this, for something which is clearly not deliberate. Like, I don't think you should book people for things that are not even deliberate. But he sent him off. And this is now a chance for Roma to make it 4-4 and to at least save the result against a 10-man team. And Lorenzo Pellegrini, who scored that amazing free kick earlier in the game, steps up. And Chesney saves it.
Mamma mia!
So that was it. There was no comeback. There was no second comeback. There was no on-field rally from Roma. There was Mourinho afterwards criticising his players. Can you think of a word that was used in relation to his defeated Roma players?
Defeated Roma players. He was critical. Weak?
Weak, correct.
Yes.
Yes.
I enjoy very much your passion.
The team played really well. We had the mentality of taking control. We started strong. We had this idea of the high press, controlling the tempo, taking the leadership. It was so good for 70 minutes. Then there was this psychological collapse. The 3-2 killed us because Felix, that's his young Ghanaian player, had an extraordinary game, which finished with a sprint against Cuadrado. I take him off and his replacement gets it all wrong. When we allowed them back in for 3-2, that's a poor old Eldor Shamorodov. He didn't have to mention the guy's name. This is the guy who he put on, who immediately made a mistake, and Jose is pointing that out just so everybody knows it was that guy's mistake. Not mine for putting him on, of course. When we allowed them back in for 3-2, a team with a strong mentality like Juventus, strong character, the fear set in, a psychological complex. It's not a problem for me letting in the 3-2. It's a problem for them, for my team. When you're in the shit, you have to get back on your feet and find your character. But there are people in this locker room who are a bit too nice, a bit too weak.
Yes.
So that's... And there is the outcome of that is that basically Roma have kind of lost touch with the teams at the top of the league. I mean, the top of the league is Inter. Why I'm talking about Serie A. I mean, I suppose it was FA Cup.
No, I like it. This is what we like about the report on sport, Ken. Can go anywhere. Do you want to hear some criticism I had for my FA Cup?
Go on.
Presenter?
Oh yeah, always.
Murph straight in there. Stephen Underwood.
Yeah.
Says hi. I wouldn't usually be on such a crusade, but after traveling back to the UK from Dublin to see my beloved Swindon Town take on Man City on Friday, my footballing emotions are running high after being sprinkled with a little bit of FA Cup magic. With the adrenaline still coursing through my veins after watching Man City pass Swindon to death on Friday, I tuned in to watch another Premier League giant, Liverpool, take on Shrewsbury on Sunday afternoon on the usually excellent Crystal Palace TV / Premier Sports 1. Imagine my dismay when within 5 seconds, Owen delivered a hammer blow to all lower league fans around the globe by describing this as the opening week of the FA Cup in inverted commas. Well, it might be the opening week for the morally bankrupt of financially rich Premier League sides that are no doubt lining Owen's pockets nicely. For fans of more humble, socially conscious sides like myself, it is a culmination of a lot of blood, sweat and negative PCR tests, giving our small little community sides the chance to taste the scraps falling from the table of the super wealthy. I don't suppose this will be read out due to Owen being in the pocket of big football, but I just felt the need to speak up for the little guy for once and ask, nay plead for you to please let us share some of the spotlight, if only for one miserly weekend. Yours in mild anger, from Steve. P.S. Very much looking forward to the return of DOD to the second captain's fold. Thanks for organising that. Well, we're all looking forward to that one, Steve. In my defence, is that what I said? That's not what I intended to say. What I had down in front of me was welcoming you to the opening weekend of Premier Sports coverage of the FA Cup. Now, sometimes what's down in front of you isn't all... Thanks, Murph. What's down in front of you on paper isn't always what ends up coming out of your mouth live on television. So if I did garble it, if I did say it was the opening week of the FA Cup, I apologise. It's one of those ones I'm saying if I said it, I don't believe I did, but I haven't got a recording that I have access to right now, Steve.
I'm sorry if you thought that's what I said.
Yeah. That man will read literally anything that's on the autocue, Stephen. Anything. I refuse to believe that McDevitt did not slavishly follow the auto cue.
No auto cue these days, Murph.
What?
Do it live! No. I'll write it and we'll do it live!
Well, in that case, there's every chance. Who knows what the hell he could have said?
Bring back auto cue, screams Murph. Anyway, Ken, I've got you back into FA Cup mode there. Off you go.
No, I think I'll stick with the old... like, there wasn't much else in the FA Cup, was there? I mean, I know people are like, oh, the FA Cup is great. I mean, it's like... It's fine, you know, it's fine.
What about Kidderminster? Kidderminster, non-league, taking out Reading.
Yeah. I mean, I always enjoy the opportunity early in the new year to take a bit of time off watching a lot of English football.
I'll tell you what I watched this weekend, lads. Dope Sick. Oh, unbelievable.
I watched it.
Ken, unbelievable. Oh.
I was watching the same thing, and we didn't coordinate that. No,
we really didn't. Wow.
It was good.
Enjoyed it. Really, really enjoyed it. See, this is what the FA Cup weekend, for me, is all about, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The opportunity to just look around and see what else is going on in the world. Watch a show about the total corruption of all aspects of
American life.
American life.
Yeah. Wow.
It was pretty good. It's good stuff.
Listen, I'm hearing a lot of Golden Globes buzz for Michael Keaton, and I'm all for it, quite frankly.
Yeah, no, he was good. I thought the end of it wasn't the greatest, but it does clip along very well for six episodes or so.
It packs a real emotional punch. If I was a TV reviewer, that's what I'd say.
The only thing more addictive than Oxycontin is this show.
Well, Murph, you see, Will Smith already got his Golden Globe Best Actor.
Has he?
You were talking about King Richard there last week.
Yeah. Sorry, I actually don't care about the Golden Globes, but I'm glad to hear that Will Smith has gotten long overdue recognition. You know, if you win at the Golden Globes, there's every chance you'll back that up on Oscar Net.
looking at this series, I see that Zlatan has scored again. Zlatan scored at the age of 40. Milan are just 1 point behind Inter. So they've got like an actual title race. I mean, Inter have a game in hand and look better. And we'll probably win, but yeah, it's not certain. And they've got Zlatan is 40, obviously, has scored now in 24 consecutive calendar years. I saw people tweeting this stat over the weekend. Inter spearheaded by Dzeko, the replacement for Lukaku, who is, I think, 36. It's great. It's just great that the old favourites can just keep going and going. And so, although, you know, you look at the Premier League, you've got Thiago Button, as Thomas Tuchel was calling him. Dani Alves set up a goal for Barcelona the other day. He's not just a cheerleader. He's also an assister, 39 years old. It looks like we've, Dope Sick is all about let's conquer pain. That was the sort of messianic vision of the Sackler guy, Richard Sackler. But we've conquered aging, at least in football. I wish these guys would share their secrets. don't ask them usual football questions. All I want to know is how are you guys still doing it? Like, I mean, is there anything you could, you know, someone was pointing out to me, this is what 40-year-old footballers used to look like. And it was a video of Jimmy Greaves' BBC interview. You know, Jimmy Greaves sitting there looking like, you know, oh my God, looking like someone's granddad. You know, and he's the same age as Zlatan is, scoring in Serie A. I saw on one of my favorite new Twitter accounts, the Twitter account had retweeted the following tweet. Throwback to when Rafa Benitez said John Terry was too old to play 90 minutes. Mourinho came the following season and made Terry play every single minute of the whole season. They won the Premier League together for the third time. Which Twitter account do you think retweeted that?
Oh, I'm on fire, but this one's easy. It's got to be JT's own Twitter account.
At JohnTerry26. At JohnTerry26 has got to be one of the best recent additions to Twitter. And it is a recent addition. He only joined in November 2021. And what does he do on this account? Well, mainly what he does is he wishes happy birthday to football players, like Eden Hazard and Ashley Cole and so on. When there's some other great player, he always likes to be in there with the birthday greetings. He sometimes puts in little photos of himself, you know, whether he's sitting in on a sort of a plane in a large leather chair, or he's like on the ski slope saying, "What a start to the new year this is," as he pans around this beautiful Swiss or Austrian or Italian, I don't know, some alpine scene. He sometimes sympathizes with sick children. He is an ambassador for the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Mm-hmm. He retweets a lot of praise about himself, or sometimes tweets praise of himself. I mean, or he tweets things which he says, this makes me so happy, and it's Chelsea fans with a banner, captain, leader, legend, great game of football today. He's sort of hanging around Chelsea. You know, he'll sometimes put up a picture of like the sign at like Chelsea saying, oh, it's great to be here. You know, and you're like, you're at Chelsea again. On January 1st, he was in a reflective and passionate mood. Can someone explain why Gary Neville, Phil Neville, Paul Scholes, Ashley Cole, Nicky Butt, Rio Ferdinand, Sol Campbell, Jamie Carragher, Wayne Rooney have never been honoured for their services to football? We are talking the best of the best ever. And then a picture of one of the medals for God and the Empire they hand out at the, you know, the awards. I don't know why they haven't been honoured. He sometimes he'll retweet something that seems a bit interested in somebody else, which is odd. This was a strange one from the other day. Opta Joe tweets, 54 out of 54. All 54 of Michail Antonio's Premier League goals have been scored from inside the penalty area. The only player in the competition's history to score more goals without scoring from outside the box is Tim Cahill, 56 out of 56. Tick. I'm like, why has John Terry retweeted this like obscure statistic? Why does he care about Michail Antonio? There's a graphic accompanying the tweet. 100% of goals from inside the box. These are Premier League players who've scored most goals without scoring from outside the box. Premier League all time. 56, Tim Cahill. 54, Michail Antonio. 53, Chicharito. 52, Gabriel Jesus. 41, John Terry. I was like, this is why. He's actually like, it's amazing. It's amazing to me. Like that he would still be on there doing this kind of thing. I honestly, I'm not aware of too many. Can you think of any other sort of players who were as big time as John Terry was, who are sort of reduced to this? Like, you know, sort of sitting there, like tweeting stuff about like how great their career was. Or like, he's got one here where he puts up a tweet of Gary Cahill. And he's like, this is a good example of his style. So it's a picture of Gary Cahill. I think he's like holding the Premier League trophy. And he's, happy birthday at Gary J. Cahill. Blue heart. Get on the size of the big man's arms. Flexing bicep emoji. I always had to make the armband bigger every time I passed it to him. Crying laughing face. So, okay. That's okay. We managed to bring it back pretty quickly to the to the main subject of this Twitter account. But the thing that he has been doing, which is, to be honest, been most interesting over the last while, is after joining Twitter and spending a while just sort of wishing happy birthday to people and putting like photos up of like his nice house and, you know, cool holidays, he started tweeting about his Bored Ape NFTs. And, you know, he's just been trying to sling a lot of NFTs. A big thank you to Ape Dads for this one. Really loving these NFT interpretations of me. It's just like a winking ape. The best one, obviously, was Christmas Day, when he tweeted on Christmas Day at 4:53 in the PM. Merry Christmas, Mrs. T. Had to get you a little something too. Thank you, D-Ape Wives or whatever, for the PFP for TT on the hashtag DAW7599, supporting the number 26, and at Chelsea FC as always. And it's a picture of a female ape wearing lipstick with I guess sort of Beats by Dre type blue headphones on, a John Terry number 26 or a number 26 Chelsea shirt, and a look on her face of precisely the kind of disappointment I would have imagined John Terry's wife actually having on her face if this really was her Christmas present, which I hope it wasn't. Terry's doing this, and I just think he's not the only player, former player, to be doing this. I've seen a lot of players have started to do this, are sort of slinging these things. I think they're probably going to end up regretting their involvement with this, and I can't help but wonder why. John Terry, just in the last day, has about one of his recent NFT offerings, which is one of the ugliest ones I've actually seen, one of the ugliest NFTs I've seen. He says, guys, I've decided today that all profits will be going to fantastic Make-A-Wish Foundation, where I'm proud to be an ambassador. He previously said a percentage of profits. Please support my auction here, blah, blah, blah. I'll also add a signed JT26 shirt and video message to the winner. Yeah, I suppose as long as people think of these things as donations rather than investments, they can't go far wrong.
You did a detailed deep dive into this entire area a couple of weeks ago for World Service members. So
I hadn't noticed before the other day, actually, that Watford have Dogecoin on their shirt. I'm not sure how I managed to miss this. Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah, Watford, if you look at Watford's shirt this season, they've got on the shoulder, their shoulder sponsor is Dogecoin. So Dogecoin is that, is like a so-called meme coin cryptocurrency, which is like a, I mean, you can buy Dogecoin if you want to, and you can see it's quite easy for you to buy Dogecoin. The price might even go up. I wouldn't expect it to. I wouldn't expect it to go very far up, but it could. And in theory, you could then, you know, turn your Dogecoin back into euros or some actually useful currency. That could happen. However, I would strongly advise you not to get involved in trading this, as far as I can see, intrinsically worthless. I don't know if the correct word is asset, but it is certainly something that you can buy. I think it's amazing that a Premier League club are actually showing that. You know, when you think about, like, we've got this situation where it's like, oh, is gambling advertising appropriate? In, you know, should all of these clubs be allowed to have gambling companies on their shirt? And then you've got a club which is advertising like a crypto pyramid scheme, like literally just a complete road to nowhere. Like this is insane that this is being pushed at this level. Like it just shows how sort of the problem sort of massively outpaces any regulatory attempt to keep up with it. Like if you think gambling is bad, like this is just, oh my god, like, oh my god. The founder, or one of the founders of Dogecoin, is a guy called Jackson Palmer. So he was one of the, I think, believe two guys who set it up in 2013, and he then broke all his links with the company. I mean, I don't know if I'm even correct in describing it as a company, a couple of years later.
Yeah,
and he's on Twitter as at Jackson. He didn't really have a huge amount to say a lot of the time, but he did last year post this thread, which I thought was interesting. And this remember is one of the two guys who set this thing up. This thing that's sponsored, that you can see on Watford shirts. I'm often asked if I will return to cryptocurrency or begin regularly sharing my thoughts on the topic again. My answer is a wholehearted no, but to avoid repeating myself, I figure it might be worthwhile briefly explaining why here. These are his tweets from July last year. After years of studying it, I believe that cryptocurrency is an inherently right-wing, hyper-capitalistic technology built primarily to amplify the wealth of its proponents through a combination of tax avoidance, diminished regulatory oversight, and artificially enforced scarcity. Despite claims of decentralization, the cryptocurrency industry is controlled by a powerful cartel of wealthy figures who, with time, have evolved to incorporate many of the same institutions tied to the existing centralized financial system they supposedly set out to replace. The cryptocurrency industry leverages a network of shady business connections, bought influencers, and pay-for-play media outlets to perpetuate a cult-like get-rich-quick funnel designed to extract new money from the financially desperate and naive. Financial exploitation undoubtedly existed before cryptocurrency, but cryptocurrency is almost purpose-built to make the funnel of profiteering more efficient for those at the top and less safeguarded for the vulnerable. Cryptocurrency is like taking the worst parts of today's capitalist system, for example, corruption, fraud, and inequality, and using software to technically limit the use of interventions, for example, audits, regulation, and taxation, which serve as protections or safety nets for the average person. Lose your savings account password? Your fault. Fall victim to a scam? Your fault. Billionaires manipulating markets? They're geniuses. This is the type of dangerous free-for-all capitalism cryptocurrency was unfortunately architected to facilitate since its inceptions. But these days, even the most modest critique of cryptocurrency will draw smears from the powerful figures in control of the industry and the ire of retail investors who they've sold the false promise of one day being a fellow billionaire. Good faith debate is near impossible. For these reasons, I simply no longer go out of my way to engage in public discussion regarding cryptocurrency. It doesn't align with my politics or belief system. I don't have the energy to try and discuss that with those unwilling to engage in a grounded conversation. I applaud those with the energy to continue asking the hard questions and applying the lens of rigorous skepticism all technology should be subject to. New technology can make the world a better place, but not when decoupled from its inherent politics or societal consequences. So that was, again, the co-founder of Watford's shirt sponsor, shoulder sponsor, talking about the product he helped to birth and which they are putting out there into the world. I don't know how much Dogecoin paid for the link up. Obviously, this sort of stuff is everywhere. I mean, if you were watching Serie A last night, you couldn't help but notice that the VAR there is sponsored by Crypto.com. The LA Lakers are now playing in the Crypto.com arena. I think that sponsorship has just taken over from Staples as the sponsor of their home ground. So, like, this is huge. And be careful. Be careful, people.
From Ireland's Second Captain Show. Second Captain Show.
It's the best thing in the world for you because it's full of protein. Protein.
This is not a dig at football people who know the game.
No respect, no honour.
Put your respect on my day.
Dog shit is bad, aren't
you? But who plays rugby?
I imagine it was like something you would expect to see in a porno movie.
No, they don't.
But they
no.
do.
No, sorry, they do not.
And the balls.
Shut up, the two of you. I just want to play commentary at a goal.
Fall off and I'll go.
Fall off and I'll go.
Fuck you, can I guess?
Fuck you, can I guess?
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like Nick.
You get the ball forward, you compete, you chase people, you close people down, you create excitement, you win balls when you shouldn't win balls, you commit yourself to the game.
It was the opening night of the Africa Cup of Nations last night, and there was an Irishman right in the thick of it, Roberto Lopez. Congrats on getting off to a winning start.
Thanks very much, man. We're absolutely buzzing with the start. So the most important thing last night was to get 3 points. I mean, we managed to do that.
I'd say particularly considering the build-up you guys have had, it was a relief to get the win.
100%. I say, like, obviously, preparations haven't gone ideally to put it best, like I say, with the COVID cases that we had and obviously not being able to have a warm-up game before the tournament. So that game yesterday was a lot of our first game, a lot of us first game in a long time. It was mine since November. So the result was the most important thing, and thankfully we started off with a win and something to build on now.
Tell us about the build-up then, because COVID hit the squad, I should say, really badly, didn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think in total we've had 19 cases of COVID at different stages. I think last night we were missing 9 players, and some of them were still in Cape Verde, including the manager. They weren't able to travel in time because they didn't have a negative PCR test. And yeah, I suppose the first day we arrived in Cape Verde, we had maybe 3 or 4 as a result of PCR tests. And then Morocco, who were meant to be playing in a warm-up game over there, they had another 4 cases. So that obviously scrapped that game, and we decided to stay in Cape Verde. And then as that went on, more and more people started testing positive throughout our stay there. Like, and yeah, it just disrupted the preparations a lot in terms of training. Like, I think there was 3 days there where we were without a goalkeeper. Like, so it wasn't ideal.
How does it affect the kind of atmosphere in the squad? I mean, do you all have to kind of stay in your rooms and this kind of thing? I mean, like, is there any kind of normality about it at all when like there's a risk of everyone sort of being knocked out of contention for a few days by getting positive for this virus?
Yeah, like that's the hard part, I think, to adapt in this whole sort of trip. Like, there's just that constant worry over you that, like, when there's a PCR test coming up, you have to kind of really, really nervous and think, am I going to test negative or am I going to test positive? This is going to be the one where it knocks me out. And especially as well as at the start, because we didn't know what it meant for our tournament. Like, if one of us had test positive, would have meant that our tournament was over before it even started? Or is there time to sort of catch up after isolation and how fit we'd be? Like, luckily, I suppose, like, having so many positive cases, We had enough in that group to try and separate away from the negative. So the lads were able to say, I suppose, reasonably fit in that time. But like, yeah, as far as like other than the time for training and having meals, which are great to be at a group, like, you know what I mean, great to be together and have the laugh. It's been difficult, I suppose, to really like enjoy the full experience of it.
You mentioned it being a stressful time in advance with the. And still, I'm sure there's a stress around it with all those positive tests. I read in your independent column that you've got a nickname for the team doctor.
Yeah, I'm not sure you'd be too happy with me saying that. But yeah, it was just one training session in particular. Like it was about, I think, 2 or 3 days before we were due to go to Cameroon. And he came out like about 10 or 15 minutes in the train when everyone was in a good mood. Coming up this training session, everyone was really happy. And then we just seen him walk across the pitch and it's like, what's going on here? And he pulled the manager away and we're kind of like stopping and looking at each other. And one of the coaches was like, no, sorry, continue, it's grand. And then he walked back out again and called everybody over. And I was thinking to myself, gee, that's it. We all have it. Like we're all goose here. Like, and but he said, I think there's 4 other players and the manager tested positive. And that was that. Like he took them away. So, I was really nervous, but like it was never really a good sight if the doctor's coming onto the train and training pitch now. So you're just kind of worrying, geez, is he coming for me or someone else this time?
Yeah, the Grim Reaper. I'm gonna say, yeah. Roberto, if you're not gonna say it.
Yeah, the Grim Reaper, yeah.
You've been okay though so far, touch wood. And you can even give a shout out to Rialto Medical Center.
Yeah, touch wood. I was lucky enough to get me booster about a week before I travelled to Cape Verde. Like, and I think it's definitely helped me, like in terms of being protected. I've had 2 roommates who tested positive as I was spending most of my time with them, like obviously in the room, like, and I've been lucky enough to avoid it, and long may that continue.
What's the dynamic been like then without the manager there for the first game?
Yeah, it was really weird. Like obviously the coaching staff here have been brilliant, like, and they've taken to it like as best as they could. But our manager, he's really charismatic and he's really passionate about Cape Verde, and he just gives you that sense of motivation of how much it means to play for Cape Verde. Like, so he was a massive loss, but hopefully we'll have him back soon for the next game, because like he deserves to get this tournament more than anyone. Like I say, he's done really well with this team. Like I say, and he's a man from Cape Verde. Like, so I'm hoping he gets here as quick as he can.
I'm sure a lot of people listening here, Roberto, are wondering, how exactly did this guy end up playing in the Africa Cup of Nations? So can you tell us the story? What's your Cape Verde connection?
Well, my father's from Cape Verde. He was born in the island of Sandy Cleo, and my grandfather is still down there with a couple of uncles and aunties and cousins. Like, so I always obviously knew about me background and me Cape Verdean heritage. And then when I was playing with Shamrock Rovers, I had a LinkedIn account that was set up years ago when I was back in college in DIT. Like, and I had a message from the then manager at the time, Rui Aguish, in Portuguese, like, which I just sort of ignored. As I said, so many people have heard this story now. I just ignored because I thought it was a spam message, which I've got plenty over the years on LinkedIn. But thankfully enough, he saw through my ignorance and he decided to send it again in English. And it was just an opportunity that I was delighted didn't pass me. And so I was straight on to replying to him straight away. And apologising as much as I could. And say, I'd love to be a part of this the squad if it's still available. And it just sort of grew legs and snowballed from there. And I'm forever grateful to that day, like where he wrote back to me in English.
Yeah, that's a great story. What was it like then trying to settle into the squad? Did you speak the language or anything like that?
No, and that was probably my biggest fear coming into the group. To say I wasn't really sure if many or if any spoke English. So I didn't really have any words of Creole because my mother didn't speak it, so I wasn't really spoken around the house when I was younger. Like, but like, the group accepted me just fine. I say like a lot more lads spoke English than I initially thought. Like, made me feel so welcome and helped me when say if I had any questions about like learning the language or what does this word mean. There were 2 coins for me to help, and I suppose I think what really settled me is they made me do my initiation song in Creole. So that was probably one of the most difficult things I've ever done in my football career, was sing a song in a different language. But it definitely helped me settle. And I say the football side of it is football, it's its own language, and that's all that matters, I suppose, when you're over on these trips.
What song did you sing, Roberto?
Oh Jesus, I think it's a song called Dança Mami Crioula. I won't give you the rendition of it, lads, because I absolutely butchered it.
No, we'll try and dig it up, maybe play at the show.
Please do, because it'd be a lot better than my version.
It's interesting to talk to you about this, brother, because I mean, obviously in Ireland we've got we often have the situation of players who weren't born in this country who play for the country, but I can't remember too many times talking to guys from Ireland who are playing for other countries. How does it make you feel to play for how did it make you actually feel to play? Was it surprising? Did you have any surprising feelings when you sort of lined out for Cape Verde the first time?
No, I wouldn't say it was a surprise. I was just so excited to represent my family and the chance to play international football. I say, like, me Cape Verdean heritage is probably something that I haven't really delved into too much and probably should have a lot earlier than I have now. And I'm just really keen just to learn more and say, be a part of it. Like, it's part of who I am. And I want to be able to tell everyone about Cape Verde. Like, so I was just really, really excited to sort of represent my family and get to know about the country of Cape Verde as a whole. Like,
so you say that you hadn't really delved into it before. Your dad didn't sort of try to lead you down that path before. How come that didn't happen?
Do you know what? It was probably more my own fault. I didn't really ask enough questions or pay enough attention. Like, my dad, be fair, like, he's always speaking about Cape Verde, and he has, like, obviously he tells the stories about before. Like, but I think through my own ignorance, I just didn't really pay attention when I was younger. Like, and even now, though, like, songs that my dad used to play, like, around the house, like, I'm hearing them now when we're away on the trips. All the lads are playing the Cape Verdean music. So I am sort of reminiscing on parts of my childhood that I should have been paying a bit more attention to it and ask a bit more questions and maybe making a bit more efforts. But look, as I say, I'm making up for it now, and I'm throwing myself into anything about the culture and really enjoying it.
Do you feel like it's actually changing you?
Yeah, 100%. As I say, like, obviously the football, in terms of it, the quality is really high. Like, so I'm developing as a player there, but it's more so as a person. I say, I'm getting to experiences, like, having these experiences where you're going to different parts of the world that I'd never go to. And as I say, learning about Cape Verde, just trying to turn yourself head first into a language that you never spoke before and the culture not familiar about, and just wanting to learn more. It's just opened my mind to so many possibilities and to take more chances in life, I suppose.
Was there any opposition at all? Did you get the sense that you were taking up somebody else's spot? By the way, you have every right to play for the country of your father, same way, you know, the people have a right to play for Ireland, even if they weren't born here. But there is sometimes that strain of opposition, and often it's probably from people who might lose their place in the squad or whatever. It doesn't sound like you encountered anything negative there.
No, never. I say, never really any negative emotions when I've been around down the squad. I say, from ever since my first day arriving, I think it was in Marseille, in 2019, everyone was just so happy to have me there and made me feel so welcome. As I even played the first game, like, I mean, I was made feel like I was the best player they ever had, like, which of course is not true, like, but just to have that support and backing from my teammates and the staff, it's a fantastic feeling knowing that, like, they want me here, and of course I want to be a part of this, like, and we're all in it together.
What were your emotions yesterday when you were lining up? I saw you singing the anthem there, knowing that you were representing the country of your dad at a major tournament.
Yeah, to be honest with you, as soon as we got to the pitch, to the warm-up, I was trying to block out with all emotions and just focus on the game in hand. Like, I think the day before and the day off, like, the nerves and the excitement were just spinning around my head and my stomach. Like, so I had to put my phone on airplane mode. Just to sort of get my head on the game. And I think for the 90 minutes or the 2 hours, including the warm-up, I was just focused on getting the 3 points and starting our campaign off with a win. Like, and then afterwards, I was just able to breathe a sigh of relief and sort of take in the moment of where we are here in Cameroon and what we achieved.
Is that easy to do, to block out the emotion like that?
No, it's not. And I suppose the bigger the occasion and the bigger the game, the harder that is. Like, but it's something that I've always tried to do in any game, whether I'm playing a league game in Rovers or, say, playing a European game, or you're away on international duty with Cape Verde. I've tried to just block out everything and focus on my job that I have to do in the game, because it's easy to get caught up in the occasion and the atmosphere and you lose what you're supposed to be doing on the pitch. Like, so I tried really hard to do it, and walk last night, I suppose.
Yeah, tell us then, when you turn your phone back on eventually, what sort of messages were you getting from, in particular, from your dad and your family?
yeah, it's just like, it's like I was showered with messages of support and congratulations, like from family and friends. Like everyone was delighted, like from my family to my girlfriend's family. They were all just like so happy for me, like, and I just a bit overwhelmed with the support and the messages that I got. Like, and I'm just thankful for anyone who's reached out, like, and look, I'm hoping like I can do everyone proud and continue to do everyone proud in this tournament going forward.
It's similar to the Euros, isn't it? The top two go through from each group, and then you've got the four best third place finishers in the six groups. So it's opened up for you nicely now. You know, the next game is Thursday, Burkina Faso. If that goes well, don't want to preempt things here, but you're into the knockouts if you win that, I guess.
Yeah, that's the joy of getting an early win on the board. Like, you know, that you're probably one win away from getting through the next round, and I say that's why it's so important to start the campaign off right. We know we have two really difficult games now coming in Burkina Faso and Cameroon, but we're here on merit and we have a chance of beating these teams. Like, so we'll be really hungry and looking forward to get to the game on Thursday, and just knowing that like a win here could put us in a really strong position, we'll be going all out to try and get them 3 points.
Have you started looking at like the kind of wall chart, like plotting what might happen? I mean, you have to play against Cameroon. It's always difficult against the host nation. Could finish runner-up. That would put you against the runner-up of Group C. You could be marking Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, for instance.
Yeah, no, honestly, I haven't looked that far at all. I think my roommate actually last night, Jeffrey, he said that if we need to finish top of this group because we could play so-and-so, but that was oblivious to me. As I say, like, my mind was 100% on Ethiopia. That's all I'm concerned about, and it's the same now. So I'm not looking past Burkina Faso, because I think if you start looking at the later stages before you get there, it can all end in tears.
I take it you're getting good support from the club as well. It's great for them to have you over there. I'm sure Rovers are supporting you.
Yeah, Rovers have been fantastic for me. So like everyone from the media team to the players and staff are wishing me well and like checking in on me. Like, and it's great to be able to represent Shamrock Rovers as well. Like, the club has been brilliant to me. Like, so I'll be able to put them on the international map as well. It's an honour for me to do that as well.
Well, listen, Roberto, stay safe over there. That's the main thing. And the other main thing is winning the games and hopefully qualifying on Thursday. So well done on last night. I should also mention that Irish Independent column is very entertaining as well. So we'll point people in that direction. Thanks so much for chatting to us.
Thanks so much for having me on, lads. Please speak to you soon.
It was totally insane. Jesus Christ. Oh my God, it's coming back to me now. Oh my God.
What happened?
After the game, I came back on the metro from the stadium to Nevsky Prospect.
It was like basically Russian Arthur's Day.
They're all beating your horns. They like rev their engines.
You've got terror of death. You think you're going to die.
Loads of people had these balloons of what I assumed was laughing gas.
Hippie crack. Raheem Sterling hippie crack.
I was sorely tempted. I was like, I really should try that.
What happens if I fall over and hit my head?
I'm in. I watched as a girl took a great big out of this balloon, right? This balloon. And sort of went, and I was sort of giggling. And then just eyes rolled back in the head, and she just fell backwards, like, poof. A couple of minutes after that, so this time a man, probably 30-ish, pitched forward onto his face. I thought, oh my God, I can't believe this just happened again. Smashed down onto concrete with his chin. He'll never chew normally again. He's gonna be half dead. But in fact, again, he was all right. Old titanium jaw. What a night, what a city, what an adventure for the host nation.
Novak Djokovic. In all the drama around the cancellation of his visa last week, there was one very important point. He was actually allowed into the country in the end. You got the sense, and we covered the story last week, that once he was in there, there was a fair chance he could end up playing in the tournament. If you don't buy a ticket, you don't win the visa raffle, as they say. And the news out of Australia today is Novak Djokovic will be immediately released from immigration detention after the Federal Court Circuit Court ordered a decision to cancel his visa be quashed. The judge queried what more Djokovic could have done to prove his medical exemption and criticised the Australian government for reneging on a deal to give him more time to defend his visa from cancellation. Judge Anthony Kelly said that he, the judge, was preoccupied and somewhat agitated by the issue of why Australian officials did not accept an exemption document provided by Djokovic from a qualified physician, backed up by an independent Victorian government panel. So that's where we're at. Djokovic is now free to enter the history books by winning his 21st Grand Slam title in Melbourne. Hold on a second. This might not be the end of the story. The Australian government's counsel, Christopher Tran, informed the court that another minister of government, the immigration minister, Alex Hawke, would consider exercising a personal power to cancel Djokovic's visa. Kelly, the judge, praised his candour, the candour of the representative of the government here, Christopher Tran. He questioned if such a power was exercised, whether Djokovic would be removed from Australia and unable to return for 3 years, which Tran confirmed was the case. The stakes have now risen rather than receded, the judge said, in a line that sounded like the end of an action movie trailer. Albeit, I don't know if it was delivered quite in that tone. What do you guys think of this latest twist? I've given you a couple of twists there. One twist is that he's fine to play, but another twist is that he could still be re-cancelled.
I mean, they're not going to do that, clearly. Surely.
Well,
I mean,
well, it's been brought up in court by the government.
That would be a crazy move, I think, by the because I mean Djokovic could take him to court again and probably and then it would be just a massive personal humiliation for that politician, and you know, I just he would already have sort of overridden his court system to do something, which I mean, I haven't read the ruling, or I mean, I actually tried to look at some of the ruling last night, but the link that you could supposedly watch it at the hearing, rather,
watch it in the live stream.
The link that you could supposedly watch it at just was collapsing. There was too many people, I guess, wanted to watch this thing, and so I didn't actually get to see him. But so this morning I saw that he'd won the appeal, and the thing that I did read was there was a 30-page transcript of his interview with the immigration official at the airport, which, you know, kind of was like an 8-hour job. I mean, they weren't talking for 8 hours. They paused the interview at several times. They suspended, but you know, it's like from midnight to about 8 a.m. This is the sort of time that this whole process is taking place over. And I have to say that in that transcript, Djokovic comes across as patient and reasonable. And I ended up having a lot of sympathy for him, because you can sort of, everyone has been in the, has had the experience of being kind of stuck in a situation with a kind of an official of some kind who had the infuriating habit in this instance of repeatedly saying the word, yep. He didn't say yes or yeah, he said yep. Like in the sort of, you're like, don't stop that, stop saying yep. I think I would have had to say that. Djokovic did not say that. Djokovic, I mean, he knew that the interview was being recorded. He probably had a fair idea that the content of the interview was being reported. He was on his best behavior. I've seen him lose it sometimes on the tennis court. He did not lose it with this immigration official, but I feel as though many in his situation would have, as it just kind of, the whole thing seemed a bit weird. Like Djokovic evidently was totally confident that all of his stuff was in order, that, you know, it wasn't a case of, oh yeah, I think we got the right visa, did we? Oh, you know, oh, there was no mistakes as far as he was concerned on his side. They checked and they'd been told this is what you need and blah, blah, blah. And he'd had COVID twice before, most recently on December 16th. I mean, I know there was this whole other thing of, well, hold on, he's supposedly got COVID December 16th and here he is on December 17th or December 18th. And he's like, you know, having some kind of a kumbaya, it's just Novak Djokovic photographed in crowd scenes, you know?
Yeah, there have been a couple of public, he was out and about a couple of times after.
A prize giving ceremony with like 50 kids or something, maskless, after getting his positive
and
COVID
you're like,
test.
Well, shouldn't really be doing that. But like, the thing is that it just seemed odd, the kind of objections that were being made. It's like, oh, no, I think there are grounds to withdraw your visa. And it was sort of not really explained why. The closest the guy came to explaining it was, he said, well, you know, when you come to Australia, it's a federal thing. You know, the federal government controls the ports. So, you know, whatever the Victoria state has told you, maybe it's a different setup here. But it all just seemed a bit kind of weird. And, you know, Djokovic, I think quite reasonably, was in a situation at one point of saying, or they were like, look, we'll give you 20 minutes to sort of tell us why you haven't got your stuff in order, and then maybe we'll put you on a plane. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, it's 4 a.m. You can't say to me now, have 20 minutes. I can't get any information now. Everyone who might be able to help me or give me information in this situation is currently asleep. I can't call anyone now. You know, kind of, you know, what am I? And I think that at this point, they eventually gave him his phone so he could like call his agent or whatever. I mean, at the same time, Djokovic's situation is different from a lot. I mean, you see Nigel Farage was like over with his family and all this, you know, and he sort of turned this into like a cause célèbre for him.
Yeah.
And, you know, did you see Andy Murray?
So I'm calling him out. Yeah, he says, please. So Farage, Farage has just decided this is a cause he'll take on, Novak Djokovic's cause. And he releases a video from Novak's brother's house, wandering around the place looking at his trophies. And Andy Murray retweets it saying, please record the awkward moment when you tell them you've spent most of your career campaigning to have people from Eastern Europe deported, with a wink emoji.
Yeah, but the key thing with Djokovic, I guess as far as Farage is concerned, it's not that he's East European. I mean, he's Novak Djokovic. He's not just any old East European. This guy is like rich and very successful. Whereas the Australian government has been taken over by COVID, fanatics. And has forgotten about liberty. You know what I mean? So it's like this is why Farage wants to get involved in this, or, you know, this is what attracts him in this cause. Like, you know, he's quite good at sort of sniffing out causes that sort of chime with his overall political project. Like, you know, remember the knee or whatever. This is his one sort of football intervention in recent times is when, you know, Millwall were booing the knee and he was like, oh, good old Millwall, at least someone's standing up for liberty or whatever against this sort of this consensus which they're trying to impose on us and so on and so forth. But I mean, as far as I know, that the minister can now say can now deport Djokovic anyway on the basis that he's a threat to he's a threat to public health in Australia.
And if that happens, if the visa's cancelled for 3 years, that's why the clarification was sought by the judge. If that was to happen, if the minister makes that call, then that would be challenged in the court as well. I think it's so embarrassing for the Australian government, for the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. We played him last week. He was doing a lot of grandstanding on this. No one is above the rules, all this kind of stuff. We got an email in from Mark Geary, who's been living in Melbourne for 30 years, explaining that Australia is going through, a lot of people might have been reading this over the weekend, but Australia is going through its worst phase of the pandemic. In the days before the Novak visa issue, the news was dominated by the lack of rapid antigen tests in the country. Morrison, the Prime Minister, was copping a lot of heat for there being a shortfall and for stating they wouldn't be free. Long queues at PCR testing centres, rocketing case numbers, all that kind of stuff. He faces an election sometime between now and July. He's trailing in the polls. By denying Novak entry, the news headlines change from the pandemic to the Novak circus, a distraction that shows how strong our border controls are, making the Prime Minister look good, or at least an attempt to make the Prime Minister look good. I read it. It's a really good email because I read a big New York Times piece which had a lot more words in it, but basically made the exact same point, that this was a clear attempt from the Prime Minister to get involved here, see which way the wind was blowing, then come down really hard, do all that grandstanding, and use the whole story as a tool to win some popularity ahead of the elections, which is fine until it backfires. The plan has hit a little bit of a snag now. So,
well, I mean, I just don't see what they can do now. I mean, you know, so what? This minister maybe has this reserve power, but like, I mean, it seems to me that if the intention is to show that no one is beyond the rules or whatever, by kind of taking it into his own hands, sort of disregarding the court and saying, well, no, you're gone anyway, then the minister might be sort of, there might be an element of, well, no one is above the rules apart from me. I am the law.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which
Judge
would be
Dredd style.
A bit risky. And even then the law might tell him to get back in his box. And I just think it would be a difficult thing to argue that the Djokovic really does constitute a risk to Australia's public health. Like, you know, whatever about like making a rule about this in general, I just find it hard to imagine how in these circumstances they could argue it with regard to this specific individual who's already sort of been cleared to enter the country by a court. You know, it just kind of seems as though, well, look, I'm not a lawyer. Why am I pontificating with this? I don't really know. But it seems to me that, oh, and I think the best way to finish this is by saying, it seems to me that I was right and that Novak Djokovic will play in the Australian Open.
I was going to tell you that, Ken. I was going to start by saying you were right, but I didn't want to be, you know,
well, how about
didn't want to put people off at the start of the conversation. So I'm glad you picked up yourself there. Sorry, Kieran.
to, how about really to finish off, we should hear from the main man at the centre of all this, which is, of course, Novak's dad. Because I think our podcast was out on Friday before he got back up on his soapbox to say that they are trying to crucify and belittle Novak and throw him to his knees. Jesus was crucified and had to endure many things, but still remains alive among us. Novak is also crucified, who is the best sportsman and man in the world. He will endure. And it looks like he will endure for another couple of weeks in Australia. And
oh, wow. So it was, he'd only gone as far as the Spartacus reference by the time he recorded on Friday.
Forget Spartacus.
And he went straight for Jesus shortly afterwards.
Forget Spartacus.
He was pissed off. He put the Spartacus stuff out and then he looked at it in paper and said, that's not dramatic enough. That's not going to get people's attention.
Well, they both were crucified, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
All three were crucified, I suppose. But, yeah. But Djokovic...
endures. He endures.
Okay, let's all go get isolating, everybody. Remember to sign up to the World Service and secondcaptains.com for all the new episodes of Isolating with David O'Doherty and indeed for a huge 2022.
But yeah, I did. I went in the rocks.
We're going to play out with a little bit of Roberto Lopez Cape Verdean music special, if that's okay, you guys.
Oh, well, I think that's a beautiful thought on.
I don't think this is the tune that he sang in front of the squad, but it is the one he says he remembers his dad playing growing up in the house in Dublin. It is called, obviously I know my Cape Verdean music like the back of my hand, but I just had better double check on the internet here, Badja, by a well-known artist called Kino Cabral. Of course, you know, Murph, Cray Badja means I want to dance.
Well, obviously, mate.
So, Cray Badja.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.